You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hi, this is Michael Silverblatt, and welcome to Bookworm. I'm sitting across from Carol Muskie Dukes, the author of two novels, most recently Saving St. Germ from Viking and Dear Digby. And she is a poet under the name Carol Muskie.
Between names.
As well, author most recently of Red Trousseau. Her last book of poetry was Applause. And we're going to be talking about a lot of things, creativity and poetry and science, because Saving St. Germ is a novel about a biochemist who is a woman and who has certain ideas in the course of the book about what makes a woman biochemist different from a male. Can you speak about that first?
I think probably Esme Charbonneau Talek, she also has many names, would say that she is a biochemist first and a woman second, but I think in the course of the novel she comes to realize that being a woman connects her in a different way to her science than perhaps it does for men, that she finds that both as a biochemist who, in her case, discovers things about the chemical components of the world, and as a theoretician, an abstract theoretician, she has to combine the emotional and the intellectual. And this is unusual in science, where normally they're extremely separated.
Before we enter what listeners may think is a complicated realm, let me say that the book is amazingly funny, that it gently inducts you into the world of gene splicing.
God, that was my biggest fear.
It is, and the most moving thing is at the center of the book, sort of like its son, is Esme's daughter, who is thought to be dysfunctional, who Esme believes is what she is, simply a communicator. And what Esme comes to realize is that if, as a woman, her brain is different from the brains of men, it doesn't have to be defined as a woman's brain. It is what it is. And she begins to get the sense, this is a book of dualisms, that if women connect the separate lobes of their brain more quickly than men, they are privileged with a different shape of perception as a result than men are. Not better, different.
Exactly. I mean, we get into the definition of what intelligence is. I was so happy to hear you say that the science, in quotes, was not off-putting, because I struggled for a while to introduce it, and I tried various ways of making it work on the page, and finally I realized that Esme really had to tell the story as science occurred to her in a metaphoric way. So, in fact, does the world occur to her daughter as metaphors? And then finally she realizes that, yes, indeed, if the corpus callosum, in the case of women, a part of the corpus callosum, which is the midbrain, the splenium is larger in women. This has actually been proven. And what was deduced from that was that women are actually less intelligent than men, even though this ensures that there's faster cerebral cortex communication, intracortical communication. Women, in other words, ideas travel faster back and forth across the corpus callosum, even though that's been documented. What was deduced was that men, in fact, that proved that men were smarter because the lateralized brain, in other words, the highly specified brain, the highly specialized brain is the brain that we call intelligent. So, in other words, women have a lot of information floating around to the cortical lobes, but it's not in one place.
And so, as a result, Esme, as a scientist, decides that what she will have is not a specialized theory, but what is called a TOE, a theory of everything.
That's right.
And she comes up with a theory of the universe. And one of the great things I thought about this book is that often when you read about scientists, especially scientists as written by poets, science seems an alien process. But I felt that her discovery of her theory is almost like the discovery of a metaphor. Yeah. And as a result, the book feels like one of the most genuine embodiments of the creative process that I've read in a long time, doubly so because it's in a field, science, which is unfamiliar to me.
Thank you. I was reading Primo Levi's amazing book, The Periodic Table of the Elements, before I started writing this book, and I realized that that's what, in fact, Levi had done, was to find a way to conceptualize the chemical elements so that they existed as metaphors. And for her, for Esme, that process, if it's successful at all, if I've been successful portraying it, that's what happens. She finds a way to be the sort of alchemical crucible for her own ideas. Of course, this costs something. In the course of the novel, she burns up, in a sense. I mean, she becomes part of what's emulated, the substance that's burning in order to produce the new material, the new element.
Well, it was funny because, you know, in the last novel, in Dear Digby, I remember saying to you that there was only one character who really transfixed me. It was the mental patient. And it was a cause, I felt, in her derangement that she had access to the language of poetry.
Right.
Here, in this book, what's thrilling is that almost everyone speaks a personalized, privileged language. Esme's language is extremely distinctive and distinguished. Her daughter, you know, it's like having Gertrude Stein for a child. And
what a thought, that's great.
The only person who does not find his voice intentionally so is her husband.
Jay, right.
Jay, who stutters, who has a block to his voice. And there's a magnificent chapter. Jay is an unsuccessful stand-up comic, and she leaps up after she's separated from him to the stage of the improv, where she completes his shtick for him using jokes drawn from physics.
Yes, from the second law of thermodynamics.
She's answering.
Hilarious, right?
Yeah, it's great. She's answering hecklers. She's kind of taking charge.
Well,
it's almost as if at this point in the book, she is so high in her understanding of the theory of everything that she can give voice to anyone.
She's also high in the sense of, you know, she's very drunk at the time. She's been drinking while sitting in the club feeling anxiety for her husband. And she does leap up on stage and does essentially what's impossible. I mean, she makes the second law of thermodynamics funny, or tries to, let's say. I mean, these people who are looking at her in the audience are just, you know, astonished that this creature has landed from somewhere, from Mars, and she begins to actually talk to them about science. I had in mind, actually, with that scene, Michael Faraday. There's a part of the novel devoted to Michael Faraday, who was a scientist whose brain functioned much like Esme's and like Ollie's, her child's. He worked with a kind of intuitive knowledge instead of what we would call, I guess, the deductive sense of, you know, arriving at scientific theory. He himself was a kind of stand-up comedian, and he stuttered. So I used Faraday as a sort of model for Jay, because Jay has the capacity to be quite fluent. Jay has the capacity to be a magician with words, but he has stopped himself. I mean, the stutter is really a metaphor for that physical embodiment of stop. I mean, he just can't get behind his own thoughts.
Well, to go back to Dear Digby for a moment, it was as if in that novel, in that character, the poet, in the form of the deranged woman,
Iris Moss, right,
entered the world of the novel and, I thought, blew it apart, you know. Here, it's as if you've become comfortable writing novels and the poet is not exiled to the insane asylum or to routines. I felt as if you were speaking in this book out of all the sides of your mouth, that there was, you know, a kind of hip satire and a kind of, I don't know, beautiful and curious inquisitiveness about the world, a kind of tone of wonder that's also there in your poetry, and fiery and political at times, and, gee, don't talk to me about that kind of ambivalent. I felt that Carol Muskie had gotten this strange full range in this novel. Had you felt it while writing it?
Yeah, thank you. That's very flattering. I don't know if I had that much confidence in it when I was writing it, but I felt saved by the science. You know, I felt that the science, the same way I think I felt in Digby, though Digby had exactly the flaw you mentioned. I think that, that its language was exiled to some degree, the poetic language was exiled. The epistolary form of Digby saved me. I really don't think of myself as a fiction writer. This is my admission I can make now freely, I guess, that I have to talk myself into writing fiction, though I love to do it. And in Saving St. Germ, the science, I felt, was my salvation, because I would, when I lost my sense of compass, or whenever I wasn't sure about where to go next, I have, again, letters to Ollie. These are sort of interstitial comments on the part of Esme. She talks to her daughter in letter form, or she does imaginary lectures. She gives imaginary lectures as if she were, you know, Madame Curie reconstituted or whatever. And then this provides, I think, the metaphoric base for the poetic language.
Well, I guess what particularly amazed me when reading this book is that usually the novel of ideas and the comic novel are two very separate entities.
Mm.
And in fact, you know, you pick up the novel of ideas, even when, say, with Doris Lessing, you read the science fiction novels, you're aware that they are allegories or embodiments of how thought works. And so you hardly expect them to be marvelous operas buffa. And Saving St. Germ is, to my mind, an amazing thing, a novel of ideas that's also explosively funny, and that's when the ideas are held to be, by the author, mm-hmm. incorrect. You know, the novel of mistaken ideas.
Yes.
In a certain way, Lolita is such a novel.
Yes. Some of Kundera is like that, too.
Absolutely, yes.
I think.
Ideas being travestied. But here, the ideas carry the weight of revelation, and yet their expression and their embodiment in the narrator is wildly comic.
I think because Esme is unusual. Probably the most flattering way to present her would be as unusual. She doesn't function as a normal character ever, although because she's outside of the club in science. And women are, indeed, to a large degree, though this is changing, excluded from the center of science, that is, you know, the place where all the information gets exchanged and so on. Because she's outside kind of from the beginning, and because she feels parentless, it's explained in the story, you know, why she feels separate from her parents, but she does. Because she kind of gives birth to herself in the way that DNA, you know, the daughter strands evolve from the original helix, she feels sort of, you know, as if she's this immaculate conception that gives her a lot of power to speak. By the way, I think women characters in general have that power to speak. They're sort of, I hate this word, but they're, you know, empowered by the fact that they have no real history in literature. You know, there's apart from, you know, Becky Sharp and the obvious ones, they can go anywhere. So she's outside of science, she's outside of history in a sense, and she can do anything. She's also brave, and that gives her some panache as well.
It's so funny that you say that, because, I've heard that before. And yet, for me, I've always thought in novels that the women, like the devil, have all the lines.
And that, but they're really usually often given them by men.
That's true. That's true, and that's changing. But it seems to me that I can think of so many interesting women characters in books, and
absolutely,
relatively few interesting men. If you think, for instance, of an all-male novel like Moby Dick, you think of the ideas and you think of the masculinity of the form, but Ahab and Ishmael are not embodied.
No, they're not. They're not embodied. So see, that's mm-hmm. what it is, I think. I think to connect in some way, to sort of ground the lightning is, dare I say this, in a way peculiarly female, in a sense, I think, because of that separation from abstraction, which is more traditional. Moby Dick, yes. I mean, the thing that's happened, I think, is the men have provided the framework. The framework is there. The history is there. You know, the whole structure is in place. But that's just it, you see. For Esme, for example, I mean, she's, the structure of science is there. It's hers to bounce off of, and hers, in a way, to undermine. And it gives great freedom to the voice, I think, to be in that position of exile or interloper or rebel. And, you know, this is not to say that novels by men aren't written in that voice. I think that it's new in many ways. It really is, I think, in the sense to have this kind of bravado is new for women. You don't, I mean, it's happening now. It's happened maybe in the last 20 years that women have been able to become, you know, outrageous. We do have some great female villains, but many of them have been written by men. So it would be nice to have an extraordinarily evil woman, let's say, present herself on the scene. I would be delighted by that. Someone was just writing about that. I can't remember who was saying, we need this now, right? Or women's sexuality. Many novels about, you know, the polymorphous nature of women's sexuality. I think we're still coming to that. And that's exciting. I mean, that's good.
It's interesting to me. You know, one of the themes of Saving St. Germ by my guest Carol Muskie Dukes is the claim that as a biochemist, as an organic chemist, what do you call this, as a geneticist?
She becomes a molecular biologist, becomes all those things have all sort of been blended in recent science.
That she is cold, and people seem to accept this from a scientist, but not from a woman.
Yes.
And yet it's also a problem, as they say, in fiction writing and in poetry. I find readers saying, I didn't sympathize with any of the characters, or all of the characters were cold, or
yes,
that she brings a harsh and austere eye to this or that. And I always think that coldness is just another temperature, like heat.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
There's no great virtue
in
exuding mush. And yet the book does bring her in a kind of synaptic arc.
Right. Does she stay cold to you, or does she become...
No, she becomes... She becomes fuller and denser as
yes,
the novel goes on.
Well, what I think also, I did a lot of research for this book, obviously, and I spent a lot of time with women who are biochemists and molecular biologists at USC and other places, and I developed a correspondence with a wonderful young woman who's a biochemist and molecular biologist at a place called Biogen in Cambridge, Leona Ling, and I learned a great deal about also what women have to project in science. Even though they're outside, they still have to project a sense of complete coolness and indifference and a detachment and objectivity, which are, you know, traditionally male virtues or whatever. In fact, they do have to appear entirely professional at all times. So this can, in fact, be a detriment. I mean, Marie Curie, you know, I did a lot of research into scientific history, too, and there's, especially in the 20th century, Marie Curie was... as everybody knows, the one woman who was sort of admitted to the higher echelon of science. She was given two Nobel Prizes, one in physics and one in chemistry. No one else has received two, and especially in two different fields. She, as a matter of fact, the same day she received the second one, she was disallowed from entering. She was refused as a member of the French Academy.
Mm-hmm.
So she, because she was a woman. So she, you know, stands as this kind of, on one hand, primary example, the symbol of women in science. And on the other hand, she's looked upon... And if you read biographies, often as, you know, the other half of Pierre Curie, and not really a woman, in quotes, because she was a scientist. What is a scientist who's a woman? Who is that?
Well, it's very funny. You know, when I went to junior high, they nicknamed junior highs in New York, and our junior high was Madame Curie Junior High School, Marie Curie Junior High, and the literary magazine was called Radium Rain.
Oh, I love this.
But of course, in a certain way, and if anyone was going to, you know, be aware, you know, I had that kind of hungry desire to know things, but they presented Madame Curie as if she were Saint Joan,
yes,
not someone who had done specific things in a specific way and made discoveries,
right,
but a woman who died by exposure to her discovery.
Exactly. And you know, Adrienne Rich's poem about this, of course, talks about, and that's a good, I think, an extraordinary poem, completely
the
embodied,
Rich poem.
Yes, about Madame Curie, which is called Power, and it ends with the line, her wounds coming from the same source as her power. And indeed, what did kill her was the fact that she dealt with radium with her bare hands. She put her hands right on the radium. I mean, they didn't know at that time what radiation burns and sickness were. But on the other hand, yeah, there's a whole lot more to Madame Curie. There's a whole lot, Marie Curie, everyone calls her Madame.
I know,
because,
it's
of course,
hilarious.
She's the wife. You
yes.
know. But she, you know, she stands as this perfect example of a woman who had to remain distanced at all times and yet was deeply in love with her husband and, you know, felt enormous emotion at his death and yet had to go on in his place and was chastised for not being emotional enough. I mean, she couldn't win.
Mm-hmm.
Once she took his place, she was a scientist. She wasn't a woman anymore. You can't be both, you know, according to the critics of life, you know, the culture at that time. And anyway, she was reduced to this kind of symbol, and that was the end of Marie as a woman.
In Saving St. Germ, the world is seen in a way as a source for theory.
Mm-hmm.
And so Esme looks at the life around her, particularly at her left-handed husband in the course of an argument, and understands that DNA is made of yes. right and left-handed elements, is made of male and female, and that all a person needs by implication to understand the universe is to look closely and yet abstractly at his or her life, mm-hmm. which seemed to me to be, you know, a magnificent perception.
If slightly simplistic, I mean, my problem, of course, was trying to take enormously complex, both biochemical and theoretical issues, and try to render them, you know, make them comprehensible. And I think I did, you know, make things maybe too, I did paraphrase too grossly in some cases, but you made it sound wonderful. Absolutely. It's, you know, that would be nice. But she does, you know, I mean, her chiral theories, and we can talk about what chirality is a little bit, I mean, lead her to this theory of everything. And it does, yes, it is the metaphor for male, female, and the notion of difference.
Well, you know, it's sort of funny. I think the kinds of things that we turn to novels for may be, in fact, a bit simplified, or at least one of the virtues that a certain kind of novel mm-hmm. can bring is not simplification, but satisfaction.
Yes.
Almost as if in the course of working things out, there are novels that present great ragged edges, but novels are in a way like fairy tales too, mm-hmm. and sometimes mm-hmm. that kind of ecstatic drawing of conclusions, if not a part of science, is a part of novel writing, it seems to me.
Well, it seems to me that scientists recently especially have embarked on a kind of fairy tale enterprise. I mean, I talked to a number of theoretical chemists and theoretical physics who said, we're looking for God.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and their sense of order now in the world is almost Elizabethan or medieval. I mean, the idea that there's going to be, you know, a toe, a theory of everything, that is indeed what they're looking for. It's something that will link the entire universe, you know, the music of the spheres. It's an extraordinary bow to a notion of simplicity in the on the part of people who were arrogant not that long ago. Not that Einstein was arrogant, but the theory of relativity really broke apart, you know, the Descartesian and the Newtonian universe and sort of thumbed its nose at all that had gone before in the ordered universe. But as Hawking points out in his book, you know, relativity held the seeds of its own destruction within its own theorizing, because it has to come to an end eventually, and quantum mechanics takes over. What he meant was, as the universe curves, I think what he meant was, as the universe curves enough, eventually quantum gravity has to, you know, come into play, and relativity becomes entirely relative, and you finally have to have something happening which is has an element of chaos, because that's the way the universe is. So in admitting that there is chaos in the universe, at the same time, scientists are also looking for something which will link this chaotic underworld to a sort of higher, a notion of higher order.
Well, that's why, in a way, the book, which concerns itself as well with themes of entropy, is interesting in that it feeds into contemporary chaos theory, in which people begin to look for the patterns, fractal theory, within entropy, patterns of deterioration.
Deterioration. I like that word. The deconstructionists would love that. Well, you know, it's so interesting. I mean, because there are, I mean, Hawking talks about the arrows of time, for example. There's, you know, the thermodynamic arrow of time, the cosmological arrow of time. But there's the psychological arrow of time. And he said, our memory has to work in a way that means that we're moving toward entropy. In other words, the world is falling apart. So when we remember things, we remember a more complete past. All of our notion of emotion, in a way, in memory, comes from remembering a former order, a more perfect world, you know, a world of answers. And now the world is coming apart. So, you know, he speaks of worlds in which you could remember the future. I mean, I don't know if that was his book, but he talks about, you know, a world in which you would remember the future but not the past.
Well, one of the most interesting... God, I'm elaborating. This book is made only of most interesting things, and
it's
I guess
fun. I like that.
But I there is a notion that we'll be discussing next week with Carol Muskie when we talk about her book of poetry, Red Trousseau. The two parts of the brain in this book are compared to the two parts of metaphor. And there is, in linkage, the idea in this book that things have to be removed and joined by heat. She imagines making connections by transferring DNA to outer space and subjecting it to bombardments and manipulations from there. I said to myself, well, that's what metaphor is, the fusion of disparate things under conditions, mental, of heat.
Unfortunately, she says, if I did do that, if I could transport DNA to outer space and bombard it with all sorts of alpha or whatever, I would probably get my high school math teacher. There's a kind of terrible, you know, finally there's a kind of defeatedness in her theory. But and this is actually when she's arrogant enough to assume that DNA is not all that it's supposed to be in terms of an answer. And that's when she also realizes that science is metaphoric entirely. I mean, the universe is a clock, as Descartes says, you know, and then the universe is, you know, is a train traveling through space with Einstein, and then the universe is a black hole, and then it's, you know, parallel universes. So our minds have to, and the helix, you know?
Mm-hmm.
We have to think in metaphors.
I thought it would be nice to close this section with by asking you to read the epigraph for part one, which comes from Mileva Maric, Albert Einstein's wife, because it leads us to the idea that our imaginations shape things from what they know, but what about the things we don't know?
Mileva Maric was Einstein's first wife, and she there's some theory that she was involved in developing the theory of relativity, she herself being a physicist. And this is her quote. In fact, this comes from one of her letters to Einstein. "I do not believe that the human brain is to be blamed for the fact that man cannot grasp infinity. He certainly could do that if in his young days, when he was learning to perceive, the little fellow had not been so cruelly confined to the earth, or even to a nest, among four walls, but instead allowed to walk out a little into the universe."
That's lovely. I'm Michael Silverblatt. I've been talking to Carol Muskie on the occasion of her new novel, Saving St. Germ, from Viking. And thank you for being with me today.
Thank you, Michael.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer today is Scott Fritz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books. To the land of vices, go in books. As you ramble through the pages, books will take you through the ages, back to days of old when knights were bold in books.
Books, 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 books. Books. Books can be funny too.
Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme.
Now it's book of the mouse. Wow. Ah.